Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, February 9th, 2017. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, Ricky the Meadmaker from Groenfell Meadery in Vermont joins us to share his best practices for making mead. Ricky has posted all of his recipes for his meads online, and he'll walk us through some important points in making the most of those when we're making our own meads at home. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing Bottle Opener. And don't forget to get a copy of our Brewer's Logbook. You can use it to log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first and click on our associate link on basicbrewing.com. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show. We greatly appreciate your support there. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We're on Google Play Music. We're on iHeartRadio. We're just everywhere. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who's done so already. We had a great time at Frostfest in Fayetteville, Arkansas this past weekend. It's a big festival put on by Fossil Cove Brewery, and I was helping Steve Wilkes at his booth for Steve's Brew Shop. And before the event, I wandered around and recorded some interviews with breweries from outside our immediate vicinity, and you'll hear that in the next couple of weeks. So much great beer in our region. A lot of fun. Ricky and I talked for a good long time, but I want to give a shout-out to our sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa. As I've mentioned before, High Gravity is moving to a bigger and better facility where they will be opening a brewery in addition to their winemaking operation and actually selling beer on-site. We'll have a tasting room there. It's going to be great. It's a forced move. Their current location is being demolished. It's under new ownership. So they've started a GoFundMe campaign to help with their moving expenses. Desiree says, moving is expensive. There's the down payment on the new place, the cost of moving our signage, our walk-in fridge, replacement shelving, and the checkout counter. The cost of so many things we don't even know about yet. It quickly adds up to much more than a small mom-and-pop store has on hand. So we're asking for your help. A loan, so to speak. Desiree says, Dave and I don't like handouts, so we're offering incentives as a payback for your help. Help us up front, and we will reward you for your help down the line when we are settled into the new place. So the incentives that they have on the GoFundMe site are very cool. And they are, as I've said before in the past, they're over halfway to their goal. So go to GoFundMe.com and search for High Gravity to check out what they're offering. And also, by the way, for for awesome electric brewing solutions, including the Warthog electric brewery controllers, go to highgravitybrew.com. And we always are grateful to Desiree and Dave for their continued support of this podcast. Okay, let's get some very helpful and fun advice on making meads from our friend, Ricky the Meadmaker. Ricky the Meadmaker, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Great to be back.
We talked to you last at HomebrewCon in, was it Baltimore? Is that where we were? I can't.
It was Baltimore. You have a good memory.
They all run together after a while. Hotel rooms full of, you know, fun people tasting, you know, alcoholic beverages and talking about them. You know, it just all runs together.
It could have been Cancun from your description.
What's been going on at Groenfell Meadery since then?
Oh, a huge amount. About, oh, I don't know, a month after I last saw you, our restaurant, Colchester's Mead Hall, finally opened. And, you know, there's this thing called imposter syndrome. And when you know, you become a pro brewer, right? Like everyone I know who's a professional brewer started out as a home brewer. And the first time someone pays you for a pint of your beer or your mead or your cider, you go, are you sure? I mean, like, I've given 100 gallons of this. What, you sure you want to give me money? And, you know, a lot of other brewers I've talked with, they struggled with this for the first year, and I did, and then I kind of got over it. And then when my restaurant opened up, we were so short-staffed that I ended up being the head chef also. And we got all these like 5-star reviews from local newspapers with this like weird Scandinavian fare, which is, I make a lot of things, but I made like house-made herring and pork shoulder and these things, and I got all these great reviews, and it was worse than ever because I was like, no, I'm just an idiot that cooks for his friends. Like, why are you paying me for this food? So that was huge. Havoc Mead, which is also brewed at our facility, which I am begrudgingly the head brewer for right now. We're looking for a new brewer, completed its lineup. So we have some really cool stuff like mole spice mead, and I think maybe when I saw you last time we had our hopped mead. But it's been absolutely wild with brewers coming and going, and now we're looking to expand out of our current facility, which is really very much in the works. So tons is going on.
And I looked at you have your regular segment on YouTube, Ask the Mead Maker. And I looked at the most recent episode, and I believe it was on that one, you said that you no longer have your own house yeast strain. You've gone commercial.
So I've saved this story for just the right brewing program, and yours is the right one. Now, people who are just listening to an interview with me for the first time wouldn't know, but long before I was Ricky the Mead Maker, I was Ricky from Wilmington, Delaware, and I wrote you all sorts of questions, and I really got my start brewing from bugging you in your inbox. And I have this amazing home brewer-esque story from my professional career that I've been waiting. I've been saving it for you. I didn't even tell you this when I emailed you. So, about 4 or 5 months ago, I brewed a batch of mead, 1,000 gallons. I mean, that's a lot from a home brewer standard. It's not a huge amount for a craft brewer, but 1,000 gallon batch, that's, you know, $10,000 worth of product on certain markets. And I had a batch. It didn't finish. My final gravity on most of my products is would read at 0.998 on my hydrometer. And this thing came in at 1008. And I tasted it, and it tasted about right, but you know, nothing I did. I recirced. I used, you know, a commercial pump, and I pushed my yeast back up into solution, and it was still at 1008. And then I got a product from the people that make Sparkaloid. It's called Rescue, and it's supposed to save stuck fermentations, and it precipitates your yeast out. So I got Rescue, and I got another commercial strain, and I threw it in the top of the batch, and the damn thing wouldn't budge. It was at 1008. It was at 1008. Nothing I did would change it. And then I locked the tank. I didn't throw it away. I had one, for whatever reason, I had a tank that I didn't need for a while. And so I brew another batch of mead with a commercial strain. I was like, forget this, forget my house strain. It's a jerk. I'm never using it again. So I pitch this commercial strain, and it ferments out, bubbling, you know, lasts 5, 6 days. I take a hydrometer reading, 1008.
Oh no.
And then I took a reading of one of my products off the tap, which I had a refractometer reading for, and it was 1008. The paper in my hydrometer had shifted. And so I had basically thrown away my house strain of yeast. But the thing about it was maintaining a house strain of yeast. And I actually was just this morning, I was a beer judge for a really cool homebrew competition that we have up here in Vermont called Make the Cut, where one lucky homebrewer gets his or her beer made in a full 30 barrel batch and like put in cans and sold throughout the state by one of the local brewers here, 14th Star. It was a cool event, but I was talking to their brewer and they used to have a house strain, and he agreed. It's just such a nuisance to maintain it that if you can find a commercial strain, especially a dry one, that you could just buy when you need it, it removes about 20% of your work. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that I could go back to D47 and I had learned enough as a commercial brewer that I could make it do exactly what I wanted. When I was a home brewer, as a commercial brewer, I don't know exactly what I'm doing, but as a home brewer, I knew even less. So I've been able to really take that strain, and after talking with a bunch of my regulars, one of the big things about D47 in mead is that it doesn't really precipitate. It doesn't flocculate out of solution, and it leaves the mead a little hazier, which is something I was really nervous about when I first started. I thought everyone would want this beautiful, crystal clear product. And the reviews of my products when they're thick and hazy have been much better. Hmm. And I don't know that it's a better mead. I think it just looks richer, more robust.
So what did that do to your flavor profile?
I think, honestly, in blind tastings, so Kelly, who's the boss who you interviewed last time, she did blind tastings, true blind, so she couldn't see the colors, she couldn't see the haziness, and she has a palate that's out of this world. I mean, she's one of the world's best. She's regularly slated for international judging competitions, and she agrees with me. There's almost no demonstrable difference. The original strains were very similar. I cultivated up my own house strain off of a commercial strain originally. And most of what people were getting in the new version was just that it looked different, which is kind of a comfort.
Huh. Well, that's a relief. Then now you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm so happy to spend a couple $100 on yeast every batch to know that I can just walk up our OSHA approved ladder, open the little hatch at the top and dump a couple bags in there rather than constantly worrying that my yeast strain has gotten to 48 degrees Fahrenheit and the you're going to start having autolysis in the keg and nightmare. It's a nightmare. Do it at home, though. If you're a home brewer, what you've signed up for is a nightmare. So you might as well have a house strain.
Now, there's news that you announced. I saw it on Twitter. Mm-hmm. That you are going to put out your recipes online in one convenient location. So are you giving away the keys to the castle? Why would you do such a thing?
So for years, we've talked about being an open source company. I have the show Ask the Mead Maker. I've been on your show before. I've been on probably a dozen brewing programs and on local television, and I will give away my recipes. Thing about making mead is Valkyrie's Choice. My best-selling mead, sort of my flagship, is honey and water and yeast. How hard is that? Mm-hmm. Honey, water, yeast. What am I giving away when I tell you? It's honey, water, and yeast. And you can reverse engineer it. It's complete. It's bone dry. It's 8.5% alcohol, and we have our honey source on the can, which means you could literally do the math and figure out how we make it. Now, you might not know our yeast. You might not know our temperature. You might not know. But when I started homebrewing, I can tell you that my craft beer consumption did not go down. I do not feel, and I think James, you would agree with me on this, that the home brewers are not taking a chunk out of the craft beer market, but rather adding a probably above doctor recommended amount to the sales.
Well, and if anything, home brewing it improves your appreciation of well made beer, and so you're going to spend more money on beer, and you're going to buy more varieties of beer, and you're going to be more adventurous, I think.
That's exactly it. And we have this in-house joke that we have two problem customers. People who have heard of mead, because if they've heard of mead, they've only really ever had that, and this is going to be, I don't know who you've interviewed, but sickeningly sweet honey wines. They've had stuff that is syrupy, and you couldn't finish more than 4-ounce snifter of it. But what we make is a craft mead. So it's, you know, bone dry. It's drier than almost any cider you would have ever had. And it's really, really tough. But the other problem is people who have never heard of mead. Because where the heck do you even start? You go like, well, you know, have you read Robin Hood, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings? You mean you start running through all these literary references. And as I said recently to someone, that every beer brewer I know, professional, the way she started was she would have a really, really good beer and she would think, I could do this at home. And every mead maker read a really great story and said, I want to be part of that. I want to be part of that story. And for me, everything I do, making mead is easy. The only thing easier than making mead is making cider. You just buy juice with cider and wait. With mead, it's honey and water and wait. But what I want is people to understand what really goes into what I do, not because I want them to have a greater appreciation for, you know, the art, the science. It's nonsense. Anyone can make it. I want people to understand that anyone can make it, that I'm making it for you. And I don't think that people are going to make Valkyrie's Choice at home and stop buying mine. If they do, good for them. When I was getting ready to go pro, I went 2 full years, other than, you know, being out at a restaurant, but 2 full years without buying commercial beer. Huh. To see if I could do it. To see if I could maintain all the beer variety that I would want in my life. And it's a total pain in the rear end. Just remember, you don't swear on your show. Do you remember the episode just after Carlin died? You allowed profanity to be in your episode.
Yeah. Was that the Jack McAuliffe interview?
Yes, it was. I was just thinking about that the other day. Because I don't curse on my show either, because I found out I have a bunch of little kids that watch it. Like, without their parents, because the whole thing's just me being goofy behind the bar, and I often do, you know, weird little video tricks where I'm talking to myself, and we have like 4 or 5 really small mediacs who come and drink root beer at my place and ask me great homebrewing questions that sometimes make it onto the show. But anyway, the idea behind it is we're never going to have mead drinkers unless we have mead brewers. And 95% of what I do is education. That's why I have a show. I mean, that Ask the Mead Maker takes a disproportionate amount of my time. And we looked it up using like Google Analytics or something like that. 95% of the people who go on our website or watch our episodes are in a part of the world where they cannot buy our product. It's really just because I still feel like I'm part of that community.
Well, you're planting seeds.
Something like that.
So in addition to the recipe section of your site, I read another post that I thought we could delve into.
Yes.
Another blog post, and it's titled "How We Brew Everything We Brew." So these are kind of your general principles.
Yeah.
Of mead making. Let's go through some of those. I think we talked a bit about some of the stuff that we're going to talk about when we did your tasting, but this is a nice and concentrated form, and there's not, you know, me giggling too much, you know, after drinking mead in between. So,
right.
So let's just go down the list. I mean, you start off, first of all, saying that your honey is never heated above 105 degrees Fahrenheit, and usually only to 94 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. Now, why, first of all, for those who don't make mead, why would you need to heat the honey, and why don't you want to heat it too much?
Right. So this is one of only two things that we're going to go through today that I would say is fundamental to the way we make what we make. The interior of a hive is 94 degrees, more or less, depending on what part of the world. But, you know, more or less, the interior of a hive, middle of July, middle of December, is 94 degrees, which means that the honey will be in a liquid form at that temperature. Now, once honey is extracted from a hive and processed, it doesn't have wax capsules and things like that, you run into this problem that, yes, it'll be liquid, but the thermal mass of honey is extraordinary. And what I mean by that is we're just working with drums of honey. I'd like to get larger packaging. And when I say drums, about 640 pounds, which I'm not going to convert to kilograms in my head, but 640 pounds of honey per drum. And we use about three of those per batch. And we can put an Air Force grade barrel warmer, the kind of thing that they use for keeping diesel and jet fuel liquid in the Arctic, on the outside of that drum, plug it into the wall, and 3 days later, it'll still have crystals in it. You can pour heat into honey, and it'll just eat this stuff. I mean, it's amazing how much heat honey will absorb. So we'll allow the exterior to get to 105 degrees Fahrenheit. I have a little thermostatic couple that shuts off the jacket at that point, just so that we don't start volatilizing the outside of the honey column while the inside is still a solid mass.
Mm-hmm.
But early on in our production, we used to allow the temperatures to approach about 125 degrees Fahrenheit. And there were these beautiful honey aromas in the air. It was just a great brew day. And then we would drink the product and it would just be sort of boring and flaccid. And then we realized, oh, if you can smell it before fermentation, that means it's gone forever.
Yeah, those aromas are for your neighbors.
Uh-huh. That's a great way to put it. I'm going to start using that in my tours. So we like to say that, you know, it's usually 94 degrees, and during the summer it is. But, you know, I'm brewing in Vermont, and I keep my facility at about 58 degrees. So, you know, we do our best to keep the average temperature there. We just make sure that there's nothing special about 105. We just sort of picked it as a cutoff for the thermocouple. And that's the same reason, you know, we mix it with 98 degree water. It's warm enough that honey and water will mix. You try to mix cold honey and cold water. We actually have a problem with that right now that I need to deal with on Tuesday morning with maple syrup. One of our brews has maple syrup in it, and I believe that all the maple settled to the bottom of my fermenter.
Mm.
Just too cold to mix. So making sure that the water is warm enough and the honey is warm enough, and then we use street temperature water to bring the temperature down to whatever we want the fermentation to start at.
So what did you like to say that you brew beer strength meads.
Mm-hmm.
What is your starting gravity? What are your ranges of starting gravities?
So,
assuming that you have a calibrated hydrometer.
Right? God knows. What's really weird about hydrometers is it was actually much closer on the starting gravity than the final gravity.
Hmm.
Because the weight was slightly off too, it seems. While we're chatting, I will bring up our new page to tell you the answer to those questions. I'm really in the – I don't go much above 1060 on anything I make. Mm. I mean, that's high for a beer. Not for a modern beer, I guess. But, you know, traditionally that would be pretty high. Valkyrie's Choice starts at 1062, but it gets to 8.5% because it actually finishes out at what would read below 1. We're so dry, as I like to point out, that the actual density of ethanol versus the density of H2O comes into play, which is just insane. But the reason you can do that is everything in honey is edible. Mm-hmm. Everything can be eaten by yeast, whereas unless you're introducing bacteria into your beer, there are going to be things that yeast won't eat.
And your meads are not astringent. You know, that I've brewed some meads that didn't have a high enough starting gravity, such that when they finished out, it was like, you know, really kind of an iced tea, kind of a, you know, astringency.
Yeah. Yep.
How do you avoid that?
So that one's tough. I have two interns every semester. So just a little call out. If you're in Vermont and you're at a university or college in Vermont, we do take interns. I mean, I guess technically I could take one from another state, but that'd be quite a commute just to drink with me. And with my first couple rounds of interns, they would ask me these questions. You know, I made mead at home, or I have had this mead, and it's, and there are two things that people complain about. One is the astringency, and the other is this thing called young mead off flavor. It has no other name. It's a known off flavor. And finally, the Mondavi Institute out in California, part of, I believe, UC Davis, they think they may have some idea of what kind of compound young mead off flavor is. But the way I describe it is it's like honeycomb cereal. Mm. It's more of a mouthfeel than a flavor. It sticks to the roof of your mouth, your cheeks. It's very unpleasant. It's gross and bready and yeasty. And they think it's an aldehyde that comes from a poor initial fermentation. So there are two things that you need to remember with mead. One, it's honey and water. It's basically, you might as well be dissolving white sugar in water, mm-hmm. from the yeast's perspective. So you are going to run into this problem that, just like humans, yeast does not do very well in a pure sugar environment. So anything you can do to make it more beer-like, because humans can live on beer. Go Google it. They don't look great at the end. But anyway, beer has all these minerals, all these vitamins, all sorts of things. And when people throw nutrients into their high-gravity fermentations, it's fine, but you're essentially doing nothing. There's plenty. There's plenty of nutrient in there, unless you have a huge amount of adjunct addition. I mean, unless you're getting to like the 20-30% honey or sugar, or, you know, molasses, and molasses has minerals, brown sugar additions to your brews, there's plenty of nutrient in there, but not so with honey. So I am a big proponent of early dose nutrient addition. When you're mixing your honey, your water, your yeast, put a ton of nutrient in there. And when I say a ton, and I'm going to be very specific this time, and I'm going to say I am not a shill for Y yeast. I have given Y yeast a lot of money, and they've never given me any money back. I put what would work out to 4 ounces of Y yeast nutrient in a 5-gallon batch.
Wow.
So we're talking literally 8 times their recommendation. Now, what I usually, or used to say, and I've said in interviews, I said it at my homebrew conference lecture, you know, add all this nutrient, but I wasn't very specific. And a whole bunch of people went home and used DAP and Fermade K and things like that. Now, the big difference is Y yeast nutrient is a mineral blend. These other ones are basically the this is not meant as an insult. This is how they're designed. They're like the moral equivalent of chemical fertilizers for fields. They don't have a lot of complex minerals in them. They are meant to supply, you know, nitrogen, I think phosphorus, you know, the important things for yeast health, macronutrients basically. And so what they were doing is they were nitrogen burning their yeast.
Hmm.
And they would get these batches that were undrinkable because I wasn't specific enough. When I say add a lot of nutrient, what I mean is, if you would like, go out and find yourself a variety of brew minerals, experiment with your water quality, build up your mineral content, and then figure out about how much DAP or Fermade K you need to create a nice, healthy fermentation. What I said was, I use a lot of Y yeast nutrient blend, which is essentially all of that done for me that just comes in a rather expensive box. So the other thing is, you are under pitching. As a homebrewer, I don't really care what you're making, but especially with mead, you're underpitching. The pitch rate for commercial brewers, if you could get access to that part of, you know, say Y East or any of the other Lalvin's website, their pitch rate works out to about 1 to 2 packets per gallon.
Wow.
You're underpitching. And the problem when you're a home brewer is, especially with something like Y Yeast, makes a great yeast, but very expensive. You know, they would be trying to tell you to do $50 to $80 worth of yeast per batch. And that's just not fun. That's just not fun as a home brewer. So what I would recommend to every home brewer is starters with mead. Mead is its own starter. Make a half-gallon batch. So mix a little bit of honey and water and put your yeast in. And then the next day, add a mixture of a gallon of warm water and honey. And then the next day, add another gallon of warm water and honey. And then wait 2 days and add another gallon of warm water and honey. And there are people that can keep a perennial mead batch. At some point, they have 5 gallons, and then they're just, you know, pulling a gallon off at the end of every week and adding more. It's like having a sourdough starter.
Huh.
It's a lot of work to do that. You have to stay on top of it. But, I mean, essentially that's what a lot of pro brewers are doing. When they extract yeast, they'll send it through, you know, 5 iterations. They're pulling their best strain. And then when things start to get a little gamey, not because their hydrometer is broken, but, you know, for whatever reason, they go, not good anymore. I'm going to buy some more yeast. But that's the two big things. Make as healthy an environment as humanly possible for your little yeasty friends and put as much yeast in there as possible. When you're talking dry yeast, though, buy 6 or 7 packets. It's going to be the cheapest part of your brew if you're using a really good honey.
Mm.
And mead is not usually hopped, so you're saving a huge amount of money there.
Yeah, I think I talked about when we were in the hotel room at HomebrewCon, I talked about my bread yeast mead.
Right!
Which I used 2 packets of Fleischmann's yeast, rehydrated, pitched into a 1 gallon batch of mead, and that thing was done, even though it was a pretty high gravity mead, it was done in like 3 days.
Right. Actually, I have a funny one. I pitched on Saturday morning. Oh, another great like homebrewer turned pro moment. I got to work. I'm not supposed to work on Saturdays. I have bartenders that run the shop and all of them brew also. But as the head brewer, I deserve, you know, 1 day off a week. But one of my bartenders couldn't come in. She was supposed to open. So I went in and it was like, oh, good, because I had to pitch a batch anyway. So I get there and I'm out of oxygen. Like, my oxygen tank has literally 0 pounds in it. And I was like, how did this happen? I was like, oh yeah, because last time I wrote a note, I found my note to myself, which was like, Ricky, before you brew again, go buy more oxygen and air gas. So I'm standing there with the other brewer, we're just looking at each other. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I mean, mead needs to be oxygenated. Beer, I mean, everything does, but mead really needs it. We have this cool pressure oxygenation thing that we do there. So finally, in what might have been a stroke of some kind, possibly of genius, I put my my maceration pump on the bottom of the tank and just turned it on and just blew bubbles from the air through my batch.
Mm.
And climbed up the ladder and then dumped in a bunch of yeast from the next batch over that had just completed fermentation. And I came in on Wednesday morning and there's, you know, trickling of bubbles. And I turned to Kelly and I go, my God, you know, I pitched this thing. You would think that it would actually be fermenting by now, but this is nothing. This is nothing. And then I noticed that there was a rather potent smell in the air, an eggy sort of smell.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, that's so the batch I had made is Psychopomp. It has a fermentation cherry in it, which I think we talked about last time, that there are still fermentation cherries grown in the world, like cider apples.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very potent fermentation. And then I went and I got my new hydrometer and I took a reading and it was done. It's not that it hadn't started yet. It was just off gassing. It had completed fermentation in 3 days, completed to 7% alcohol.
Wow.
And so now the other brewer and I, DJ, he and I sat around with the interns, like just spitballing, you know, what we did right to complete a mead fermentation in 72 hours. And our guess was not that there, that not using proper oxygen and using a bubbler was somehow better, but that we had pitched substantially more yeast than usually do to try to account for the fact. And it wasn't all good yeast. You know, it was usually professionals. What we'll do is we'll pull out of the center. So that's what your racking arm is for. It pulls the creamy yeast out of the center of the stack with your low flocculating lazy stuff on the top and your ultra high flocculating alcohol intolerant stuff on the bottom. So you're hopefully selecting for a strain that's akin to what you pitched. But I just pitched it all, you know, just everything I could get to make up for the fact that I had not oxygenated to my normal standards. And, you know, I have a brew your own big article coming out in a few months. And that's basically what I said after. And I don't remember if I referenced you specifically, but basically, yeah, in some ways, it doesn't matter how good your yeast is. It almost just matters the quantity.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, people are afraid of weird yeast off flavors from bread yeast. But, you know, my theory is that if it doesn't have to grow up any cells, it's not going to have that opportunity to, you know, throw off those weird off flavors. You know, if you pitch enough yeast that it can just get to work and not grow,
right,
you know, it'll just digest the sugars and go to sleep.
Yeah, and it will go through a variety of metabolic phases, and there will be a growth stage if there's oxygen present. But it won't have time to mutate, and it won't, as you said, it'll reuptake if it does make any of those weird flavors as it's growing. The healthier you can make that environment, the better.
And you mentioned, you say one of the points is we oxygenate the ever-loving heck out of all of our products pre-fermentation. Then we are very careful not to introduce oxygen at any later stage.
Correct. Here's a fun thing. There's millions of dollars in beer research. There is probably billions of dollars in wine research. I like to think that the majority of the mead research on Earth is done at my facility. So not a lot of money in it. And there are a few things that are very poorly understood. One of them is the effect of nitrogenation, N2 instead of CO2, on a batch of mead. The effects of aging. There are all these things that people will tell you what's happening during the aging process, and they're wrong. They are wrong. We don't know. We have no idea what's going on. But one of those other things that is really sort of tricky is when you oxidize. So oxygenate is usually used for adding oxygen before fermentation. Then oxidizing is post-fermentation. I believe just by convention. I don't know that they are fundamentally different for normal people. But when you oxidize beer, you get papery off flavors. And when you oxidize wine, it's a little more complicated, but you tend to get sherry-like flavors, or sherry flavors if you've actually managed to sherry your wine. And when you are doing wine competitions, when you're judging wine competitions, you tend to find batch after batch after batch after batch after batch of wine tasting like sherry. And the reason is people are so obsessed. Winemakers are so obsessed with clarity that they rack and they rack and they rack and they rack and they rack. And they don't just do a secondary. They do a tertiary and a quaternary. And every time they do that, they're introducing oxygen. And when you have a honey wine – now, we differentiate between craft meads and honey wines. Craft meads have bubbles. They're lower alcohol. Honey wines are usually double-digit alcohol. They tend to be still. This is, again, by convention. There's no hard or fast rule. You know, wassails, which are 10% alcohol, tend to have bubbles. So where do they fall? Just like barley wines, what the heck are they? But when you rack a mead, especially a craft mead, something that has CO2, because CO2 will protect it from oxidizing because the CO2 is there, it doesn't oxidize quite like beer or wine. You tend not to end up with mead sherry.
Hmm.
But you can. And we have a regular contributor to our Ask the Mead Maker. He submitted a bunch of questions, and he had written to me about how he had done this thing, and did he ruin his mead? And I, as always, you know, being, oh, I don't know, the chaplain of mead making, said, no, sweetie, you're fine. I was wrong. He had ruined it. And he had put his mead like in, and I believe he said secondary, but I think he had racked it twice. He had about 2 gallons left after all this racking, and he had put it in a 5-gallon carboy.
Mm.
And so there's a huge amount of air in there, an absolute enormous amount of air. And he had managed to sherry his mead. And he said, if you like honey sherry, it's excellent, but that's not what I was after. And why exactly this happens when you make sherry, I have made sherry in the past intentionally. You know, you use acetobacter and you have, you know, these muciliform bacteria, and it's disgusting, and you create a pellicle. Michael Tonsmeyer and I talk about it from time to time. Why do we keep doing this? It's so gross. And then then when you're done, the worst part is I said to him one time, I was like, when you're done, you still only have sherry. Like, it's not like you have sake. Like, I've made sake a couple times, and it's worse than making sherry, but at least when you're done, you have sake. But when you make sherry, all you have is a good sherry. So we don't know exactly what's going on. You can introduce more bacteria, more air contact, but you know, if you're sulfiting, you know, you're not getting bacteria. If you're sorbating, you're definitely not getting wild yeast, but you do get weird papery flavors when you expose any fermented beverage that isn't distilled. You can leave your brandy out in a decanter for 20 years and it will never oxidize, but meads and wines and beers all will.
So you mentioned sulfites, and you talk about sulfites in your list here. Yeah. Talk about the role that that sulfite and sorbate play in your meadery.
Right. So I, very early on, probably within the first 6 months, so I haven't missed a week writing a blog post since we started our company 4 years ago. And one of the earliest articles I wrote was Them's Fightin' Words. And when you are sitting in a group of homebrewers and you mention one of two things, sulfites and mead making or boiling and mead making, someone will stand up and act as if you didn't just make a pointed comment about his now deceased grandmother, but a particularly raunchy one. I mean, they will act. And I should put this in context. Like, I was a chaplain in a women's prison, right? Like, all the stuff I do in my life now, like, I was a sign language translator for a little girl with cerebral palsy who lived in a wheelchair and communicated with a computer, but had like super high IQ, and the whole world was very frustrating to her. So when people are really upset about sulfites, I'm like, come sit with me for 15 minutes. my favorite brewers in the state of Vermont, they have done 3 to 4 tours in the sandbox each. Like, sulfites are not worth getting angry about. But for whatever reason, in the Western world, sulfites are something that people fight over. And a big piece of it is, for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, potassium metabisulfite sounds like a chemical, right? sounds like a chemical, whereas sodium chloride, which is common table salt, mm-hmm. people just go, oh, salt. So you throw salt on a pork shoulder and you leave it out in the open air, and then you put carcinogenic compounds all over it, and then people are perfectly happy to buy ham, right? that's ham. Why people have gotten so up in arms over SO2, they think it causes headaches. It doesn't. Go Google it. I have articles about it. Winemaker magazine has articles about it. Brew Your Own magazine has articles about it. Sulfites do not cause headaches. It's probably the same problem that MSG faces. MSG is an innocuous – I mean, it's the same thing that makes mushrooms taste good. Mushrooms are full of this stuff. It just got a bad rap. That said, what sulfites actually do is two things. They kill/suppress wild yeast and bacteria. So when you're working with raw honey, you have tons of wild yeast in there. Tons of wild yeast in raw honey. And we have a wild mead. Nordic Farmhouse is a wild fermented mead, which is really cool. The recipe for that will be available on Tuesday as well. And every batch is a little different. My customers know that. My customers know that this can of Nordic Farmhouse that was a fall harvest honey is going to taste different from the one that was a spring harvest honey, just because of, you know, what the bees were able to forage in that part of Canada at that time of the year. But if you want to have a very consistent batch, you're going to need to suppress or kill your wild yeast. So that's one thing that SO2 does, is it kills wild yeast. That's why people sulfite in primary fermentation. And if you want to back sweeten, you need to sulfite, you need to suppress that yeast in post-fermentation, or you need to filter. From my perspective, filtration is far worse than sulfiting, because you're going to remove a whole bunch of flavor. So that doesn't seem great. You've put a lot of work into this thing. But again, personal preference. We don't tend to sulfite post-fermentation because we ferment completely dry. The only time we ever sulfite fermentation is when we have to add something that has sugar in it. And one time in 10 years of brewing, this includes being a home brewer, I've only had re-fermentation on one occasion. And it was about a month and a half ago. And we had to individually open 8,626 cans because I made an absolute rookie mistake. Usually when we make Root of All Evil, our ginger mead, we put the ginger in, we put the lemon juice in, we give it a couple days, we chill it, carbonate it, and then put it into cans. But I was in such a rush that I chilled it, carbonated it, added the ginger and the lemon. Well, any rank homebrewer, novice, first couple batches will go, wait a minute, doesn't lemon have sugar in it? So sure enough, after about 2 weeks in the cans, the yeast, because we don't sulfite, we don't strain it out, we don't do anything, the yeast wakes up, goes, hey, more sugar, and started blowing up cans.
Mm.
Yep. Never again. I made a little comment on our How We Brew Everything We Brew. This prevents re-fermentation and exploding cans. I wasn't being glib about that. If you do it in glass, very few home brewers have a home canning unit. So they'd have bottle bombs, which are far more dangerous than popping cans. So sulfites save lives. I mean, sulfites keep your sweetmeats from blowing shards of glass into your loved ones. They are not something to screw around with. If you want to have a sweet mead, you are going to sulfite and sorbate it, or I will come find you. I mean, either that or filter it. You could filter it. There are home filtration kits that will there's a name for it. They go down to a level of micron where it will even pull out bacteria and yeast.
Or I guess alternatively, you could just put so much sugar, so much honey in there.
Excellent point.
Yeah. That the yeast just says no more.
No. The only thing is, if you wanted it carbonated, you can't do that.
That's true.
Since everything I make is carbonated, I don't really think of that as an option, though I do periodically remember it and put it in articles. But you're absolutely right. You can surpass the alcohol or sugar tolerance of a yeast, in your case, probably alcohol tolerance post-fermentation, and end up with something that does not pop corks. Though someone at the table of my homebrewing competition today was a homebrewer, not a professional, and he had popped a few bottles recently, thinking that he has surpassed the alcohol tolerance of his yeast, and he had not.
Yeah, my bread yeast mead, which started out, I think it was like a 1200, 1.200 specific gravity.
Jiminy Christmas.
Yeah, but it got all the way down to 1020.
My goodness. Yeah, so, put enough of it in, that stuff will go.
Which it was a little sweet for me. So yes. Yeah. I think I would start lower next time. But man, we've covered a lot of stuff that's on that page, and I think I'm going to put links to this content in the description of this episode, and also on our Facebook page as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're recording a little ahead of time, so surely that by the time you hear this, the recipe page will be out there as well.
Good golly, I hope so.
So where can we find all this stuff, Ricky?
So, the best place, you know, Havoc has a page, Colchester's Mead Hall has a page, but where the vast majority of our educational content goes out is in the blog of Grunfell.com. That's G-R-O-E, N as in Nancy, N as in Nancy, F as in Frank, E-L-L.com.
Well, there you go.
And we're obviously on Facebook and apparently on Twitter. How cool. I just heard someone told me that I'm on the gram, and I was like, wow, do you? And then I was like, oh, you don't talk to my Grammy also. That must be another internet thing.
That's a new one for me. I don't know that one.
On the gram. It's Instagram. And if you're over 65 years old and you're on the gram, you're called an Instagrammy. That's one of mine. See, I can make internet jokes. I'm practically a meme. Is that a thing?
All right, Ricky. We appreciate your time, appreciate your knowledge.
Of course.
And if you have questions for Ricky the Mead Maker, you can, I'm sure, submit them through the website, or you can send them to me and I'll forward them on. And maybe your question can be on Ask the Mead Maker on the YouTubes.
And I'm one of those guys. If you want to email me directly, it's Ricky, R-I-C-K-Y, at Grunfell.com, just like I spelled it earlier. I'm happy to respond to you directly, and I don't care how silly or stupid or noob your question is. We will get to it if we haven't already, because James from Basic Brewing Radio answered all of my silly noob questions a decade ago, and now look at me.
Paying it forward.
Paying it forward.
Thanks, Ricky.
Thank you, James.
Well, thanks again to Ricky. Always fun to talk to Ricky. And you can find his and his wife Kelly's recipes, not only for the Grunfell meads, but for the Havoc meads as well, at grunfell.com/recipes. And boy, after talking to Ricky, I think my next batch is going to be a session or beer strength mead brewed with bread yeast. So stay tuned for details on that. If you have brewing questions in the meantime, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't tell us where you're from. No, tell us where you're from. Don't forget to tell us where you're from. How many times have I read this? I'm hungry. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcast. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. You can find a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can find our log books, where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at Basic Brewing Shop. .com. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Featured products this week that are purchased through the link are Food, A Love Story, Where Do I Begin? And Hammock. Hammock Sky Brazilian Hammock. Two-person double for backyard, porch, outdoor, or indoor use. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. Well, that's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.